the San Francisco Bay Area. It's time for Live from the Bay with Joey. Here's Joey.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Live from the Bay with Joey. That was some rocking music, and thanks, Matt Baker, for that great introduction. As you know, you've heard Matt's voice on many, many different stations, Animal Planet, oh, my God, the list goes on, the Weather Channel, the list goes on and on. But, you know, I'm really jazzed about tonight because, really, we've got a really great show. So our guest is Donzelay Abernathy, actress and civil rights activist. You know, this is really, really appropriate. Let's talk about, you know, the year 1964, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It's 50 years later, folks. And so we're going to be touching on that, and we're going to be touching on her career. I like to say my marketing saying for Donzelay would be really from the steps, really, of I have a dream to living and acting the dream. How about that, you know? So all the way from Southern California, I think I have joining me right about now should be Donzelay. Are you there, Donzelay?
I am. Hi, Joey. How are you?
I'm doing really great. How are you? Welcome.
I'm excellent. Thank you so much for inviting me to be a guest on your show.
Oh, you know, it's really appropriate, and we're really jazzed to have you. And, you know, really, quite honestly, you've had such a great career and really a really choice beginnings, you know, with your father, and let's just, we're going to touch a little bit on that, but let me share a little bit about your background, really,
okay,
with the folks, and I think this is really important. So you won, as an actress, you won the TAM Foundation 2012 Artist Award for your work and script, Birmingham Sunday. Yeah, and then also you start for 4 years and about over 60 episodes as a series regular on Lifetime Television's critically acclaimed dramatic series Any Day Now. And you also receive recognition from film critic, as we remember, Roger Ebert, for your performance in the Warner Brothers film Gods and Generals. And,
yeah,
you know, all your accolades goes on and on and on. And, of course, people remember you from your recurring roles on the TV series Easy Streets, Commander-in-Chief, Lincoln Heights, Dangerous Minds, and Amazing Grace.
And The Walking Dead.
And The Walking Dead. How about that? So, but let's touch a little bit on, you're the youngest child born to Mrs. Juanita and Reverend Dr. Ralph David Abernathy, who really was not only a best friend to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but he really walked hand in hand with him and in this whole thing during the Civil Rights Movement, which really changed the course of really American history. So you were there on the steps of that great and famous speech that everybody knows about. Tell me a little bit about that, and then walk me through how you went from that and being raised in church, in a Baptist church, I'm sure, and going into film and how that went. And since your father's passing, I'm sure he was a great support of your career. So let's talk a little bit about that. So can you take me and all the listeners back to that time?
Yeah, so let's go back to actually, it's 1963, and it's the Birmingham movement, and Birmingham happened because black people and people of color were not allowed to go into department stores and try on clothing.
Can you imagine?
And so,
That's bizarre.
It's incredible. And so what they decided to do, Danny and Uncle Martin, was to boycott the department stores at Easter time because traditionally black people spent more money for clothing at Easter and than any other, you know, racial group. You know, we had to get a brand new Easter basket, a new Easter suit, Easter hat, the whole nine yards. And why were we doing that in, you know, supporting these stores that would not even give dressing rooms to us? So, you know, it was like boycott the stores where dungarees don't spend any money. And so they arrested Daddy and Akhamadin, threw Akhamadin and Daddy in jail, separated them for the first time. Akhamadin writes a letter from the Birmingham jail. Very shortly right after that in Mississippi, people were so angry they murdered and killed Medgar Evers in the driveway of his home. And while Daddy and Akhamadin, as soon as they're released from jail, they turn the water hoses and the dogs on young, innocent children, elementary school children, high school children, young people who were trying to march for their freedom in Birmingham. The entire nation is looking at them. So then A. Philip Randolph has organized this second version of the March on Washington, So We Go. And not only are we there, but people from all over America, because the social consciousness of America has been raised by what is happening in Birmingham in the South, because they see on the evening news the water hoses and the dogs being turned on these young, innocent young people. And so we're there in Washington, and it was just incredible. I'll never forget that day. You know, we had to lock arms, and there were these men with these arm bands who led us through this crowd that was just like an incredible sea of people of all different colors, shapes, sizes. You know, I'd never seen a more diverse group in my life. You know, growing up in the South, you know, it was either just black and white, and primarily black people were on one side of town and white people were on another side of town, unless, of course, you had to go into the white section of town for work. So, you know, our worlds were very segregated. So here we were in Washington, D.C., I'm this little bitty girl. I mean, I'm a tiny little thing. I'm, you know, what was I, 5 years old.
I was just going to say I was about 3 years old. But I have a question for you. Can we just back up really quick? So I don't remember 1963 very well at all. You know, being 3 years old, I probably had no real clue. But I do remember being raised here in California. Now, I don't think we had those issues at all, right?
Well, you did. You know, restaurants and hotels are pretty much segregated. Communities are segregated. But it wasn't as blatant and as hateful as it was south of the Mason-Dixon line. You know, the South, they were still angry because of the supposed civil war, which they call the War of Northern Aggression. And so they still had those issues, you know, all the way back to the abolition of slavery. And so there were definite lines. There were neighborhoods where blacks not allowed, you know, whereas here in California it was different because you had a more diverse population. You had a huge Asian community.
Right.
You have a huge Latino community.
Right.
You have a black community, and you've got a diverse white community. I mean, you've got immigrants coming in from everywhere, but primarily because the weather is so lovely. The mountains are just so incredible. California is such a beautiful state.
Right.
You know, so it's like coming to paradise in America. So it was a much more diverse, and racism was much more subtle. However, there were the days of segregation here, and I remember, because I'm working on this project, I'll tell you about it in a little bit, but Lena Horne talks about living in West Hollywood where black people were not allowed and having an apartment under a white woman's name. You know, the woman had leased the apartment for Lena Horne, and Lena lived there. Mind you, she's working in the studios, but she could not, you know, have it as a black woman. And also around that time, there was this real estate agent named Elaine Young, who then purchases a house for Nat King Cole, and the neighborhood assumes that a white person is going to be living there, not a black person, and then in comes Nat King Cole, this very famous singer who everybody loved to listen to, but never expected to live next door to, and he would be the first black man who would integrate that area and I guess Beverly Hills. But
let me
tell you, but so we're there. So it's, you know, California's got its thing going on too. I don't know about the Bay Area because I wouldn't go to the Bay Area until after 1965. But so let me just tell you really fast. So we're there at the March on Washington and we're holding hands and I saw people, you know, on the ground, you know, because it was like a park there, that stretch of the mall between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument. That was the mall. The reflecting pool was there. And we walked, you know, through to the secure area, and then we walked up to the steps, and we sat on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And my dad, you know, made a brief introduction earlier that day. I have no memory of it. I have only photographs from it. I'm with my sister. I remember running around Lincoln's statue and being told to quiet down, you know, because there weren't a bunch of children there.
Right.
And then being told to go sit with my dad on the steps, and I remember going and sitting with my dad. My mother didn't sit with us that day. My mother sat down with Uncle Martin and Aunt Coretta. And so there are photographs of mother seated next to Aunt Coretta and Mahalia Jackson, who we called Aunt Mahalia, when Uncle Martin delivered his I Have a Dream speech, but I'll never forget it. I was told to go sit down. I guess Uncle Martin had already started his speech. I don't remember hearing the beginning of the speech, but I remember when he started to preach about his four little children, and my sister and I jumped up and down screaming because we felt like he was talking about us. You know, his kids weren't there. Yeah, I mean, we took it all so personally, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Uh-huh, and then I remember seeing the movie stars. And recognizing them because my grandmother had been living with us during those days, and mm-hmm. she had a broken hip, and she watched all these old movies on TV, and I remember seeing the movie star, so I knew them. They were the only people that I knew. And while I'm sitting there on those steps, that's when I knew that I was going to do what the movie stars did for a living as opposed to do what Daddy and Uncle Martin had done because, you know, the threat of death was so imminent with what Daddy and Uncle Martin did, and they had just killed Medgar Evers, and so I knew, I just thought, I'm going to live, I don't want to die a violent death, and I just thought that civil rights brought a violent death. They had bombed my parents' home before I was born.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There was the constant, you know, threat of death. We'd be outside in the backyard playing, and the policeman would come and watch us in the backyard. And my mother would, you know, yell at them, don't you touch my children, leave my children alone. This is when we lived in Montgomery. And so, you know, there was this, you know, state of fear around you, you know. So Hollywood
what a way
was a great
to
escape.
Yeah, what a way to live, though. I mean, I can't even imagine. I mean, I never experienced anything like that. And then again, we didn't have that. You know, I wasn't subject to anything like that in my years growing up.
Yep. But young people today can identify. The young people that live in the inner city, that
right.
live in violent areas and they're afraid to walk because of gangbangers and drive-by shootings and things like that.
Right.
Those young people can totally identify with me. When I go to schools and I speak,
right.
those kids start speaking up. They know exactly what I talk about when I talk about going to bed at night and being afraid and hoping that I live through the night, hoping that no one bombs the house or nobody shoots or anything like that. Mm. Yeah. And that's what inner-city kids endured. That's the closest that I can, the closest correlation I could make. Only
right.
the difference is, what? I'm sorry.
No, I was saying right. I mean, the thing that I, you know, that I'd like to interject here is you made a really great point, but you're talking about inner-city kids. But you know what? It's not even that. you know, you can take, I know the neighborhood I live in, this area has never had, in the 50 years that it's been around, it's never had burglaries, it's never had violent attacks on people until the last 2 years. And I'm going to tell you, it has changed people. People are absolutely frightened. I mean, they're in fear. And I can empathize with you because I understand now what that's like. And to live that as a child and to live that years ago, I can't even imagine what that must have done to a lot of those people that live that. But, you know, one thing you said is just on those steps that day, you knew right then that you were gonna go and make movies and go to Hollywood and do all that. How did you know? Was it something that was inside of you, like an inner voice that just said, you know what, this is where you're going? I mean, how was it something that you just thought, you know, I'd like to be like these people, I would like to act? I mean, how did that really – I'd like to know if it was like this voice, this inner voice that spoke to you and said, this is where you're going, or how did that all happen?
Well, when I was four, we started taking ballet, and so we would have these performances. So we would already perform, and then we would put on plays for our parents. We put on a Christmas play and an Easter play every year, twice a year. But when I saw the movie stars, I liked what they did. My mother got the Vogue magazine, and I loved looking at the pretty ladies dressed up. And those people weren't doing civil rights stuff. They were doing a more glamorous, what I assumed to be an easier life. Actually, it isn't necessarily easier. I assumed that it was, but I guess I knew that day on those steps. I guess it was that inner voice that this is what you're going to do, Dauntelet. Because I remember seeing Marlon Brando and Paul Newman, and seeing Sidney Poitier. I remember that, and I'll never forget it. And I guess it was that inner voice that spoke to me as a little kid. It had to have been. I know that a few years later, during the Selma to Montgomery March for the right to vote, the movie stars came down again, and Tony Bennett was there singing. That's when first time I'd ever heard the song, I Left My Heart in San Francisco. He sang it, you know, on the grounds of St. Jude's Hospital. And I'm sitting there on the stage. We sat on the stage in my dad's lap, and I'm hearing this gorgeous song. I mean, gorgeous song. And I remember standing backstage with Peter, Paul, and Mary and being so totally mesmerized and thinking, oh, yes, this is the way to go. I don't have the voice to sing, so I'm not going to be the singer. But this entertainment thing, yes, this is it.
And how cool is that?
And the civil rights people, it was incredibly cool. I don't know. And, you know, I was always an artist, too. That's the other thing. I looked at life differently. I could draw before I could write. And, you know, earlier today I was looking at some pictures that a friend of mine had posted on Facebook of our nursery school and kindergarten band, and then the kindergarten little group, and we're dressed as these señoritas in these long Spanish dresses. And it's so weird. Of all the little girls, there were about 12 or 13 of us. I'm the only one who has pulled my dress off of my shoulders. And you can see my shoulders. It's like, you know, I'm thinking I'm Rita Hayworth or something. And all the other little girls have their shoulders covered, and they're, you know, they're like little children. And there I am posed. I'm 5 years old, the same time of the March on Washington. It was so funny to see it. And I was like, look at me. I'm really a dancer. I took the stance, and you know, it was just incredible. I presented myself so differently, huh?
Well, that's amazing. You know, when you said Rita Hayworth, that just, you know, hearing this stuff, because I'm just listening to all this stuff about civil rights and, you know, and I'm saying, gosh, I didn't have to live that as a child and stuff like that. But, you know, I was thinking, you know, it wasn't just, I heard not that long ago, Martin Sheen, you know, the actor Martin Sheen.
Of course.
So he had to take, you know, his real last name is Estevez, so, and
right.
He's half Spanish. And he was talking that when a lot of the Spanish speaking actors, now his father was from Spain and Rita Hayworth's father was from Spain as well, but he said that they, and I think some of the Italians too, when they came to Hollywood, they had to, so here's racism too, they had to change their names.
Mm-hmm.
They had to change their look, and I think with Rita Hayworth, because you mentioned her, they had to, because she had real curly hair, curly black hair, they had to straighten out her hair, and they had to do something to her hairline, and then they dyed her hair kind of red, and that's how she began. And I'm thinking to myself now, and that was in the 50s, and I'm thinking, wow, I couldn't even imagine that. I never had heard of anything like that. So, you know, I think when we're talking about civil rights, it really does encompass a lot of people, you know, it encompasses all of us. And, you know, my mind started thinking, I was like, gosh, can you imagine, because you had touched on, let's talk on like Hispanics. Well, so Hispanic is really not a race. So, you could be white and be Hispanic. You could be black and be Hispanic. So I'm thinking, what would have happened to some of those blacks that were Hispanic? You know what I'm saying? During this time, did they encounter the same type?
Oh, for sure.
Of racism.
Oh, for sure. Anybody
yeah.
that wasn't of an Aryan descent.
Wow.
I remember when in 65 when we integrated the elementary schools in the state of Georgia, and there were two little Jewish kids in my class.
Mm-hmm.
And they terrorized them so much so that they left after a year.
That's terrible.
Uh-huh. And it was like, are you kidding me? I'm Christian.
Wow.
Jesus was Jewish. I'm Jewish too. That's
right.
What I think, you know, I'm Christian, but I'm, I'm following Christ. He was Jewish.
Right.
So, but the level of, I don't understand. My dad used to say, we hate each other because we fear each other. We fear each other because we don't know each other. We don't know each other because we won't sit down at the table together. And I really think that's what it is. We need to sit down at the table together and break bread.
Yep.
We need to get to know each other.
Yep.
And, like right now, I live in a very Hasidic Jewish neighborhood, and I love it.
Right.
I love it.
I
feel so safe, and I'm, and I stick out like a sore thumb in my neighborhood, and it's wonderful. And when I walk down the streets, I say hello. And I know that everything gets quiet on Friday night for Shabbat, and Saturday they're going to, to the synagogue. And when they come back, I'm like, hello, hello, hello. And now the young men know me. They walk down the street. They're like, hi, how are you? And I just, I feel like if no one else is going to extend that olive branch, I am.
Oh, that's cool.
You know?
That's cool. Now,
in your
neighborhood, you just touched on something. Would you say that 90% of the people there are Hasidic, or do you think it's a higher percentage? Are there very few?
No. I would say it's 75% Hasidic, and then the rest are WASPs and in my building, I'm the only black person, but across the street there's a black couple. And I'm sure they're more, in the neighborhood because of the neighborhood where we live, there are more people of color. I don't know of any, there was an Asian woman, I take that back. She was part Asian. She just moved out a few days ago. But, you know, it's primarily Jewish for sure. I love it. I really do. And I'm learning. I learned their culture and have respect for it. But at Christmas time, I have my tree and my lights and, you know, and they're very kind and very loving to me. And there was no discrimination. I feel very much at home here, as well as my husband. And so this is where we are. For now, this is where we are.
That's very cool. That's very cool. And, you know, really, I mean, when you think about it, you touched on a point. You know, if you claim to be a Christian, this is not a Christian show by any means, but if you claim to be something, then live that.
Right.
You know, and part of that is extending yourself out to people and showing love and kindness. And in a world that's so narcissistic, it seems, and at least where I live, it's even growing more and more because Silicon Valley and, you know, high tech and home of Google and all this kind of stuff. It seems like everybody's so self-involved, they don't have time for anybody else. If you can really sit down with people, and you said about breaking bread, you know, it's interesting. I have a friend that's a pagan that it was actually said the same thing. Said, in our family, we have Christians, we have Muslims, we have Jews, we have, you know, we don't care, but we sit down together and we break bread together. And this person said, this is what's wrong with, you know, the American culture today. This is what's wrong with a lot of families today. They don't have time for one another. They don't sit down. They don't know what's going on. All they do is they're on their computers, iPhones, iPads. You know, they just have no time because everybody's so busy. And so it was really wise what your father really said, because it's absolute truth. How are you going to get to know somebody if you don't sit down, if you fear something that you're, and it doesn't matter if you're black, white, purple, green, brown, you know, polka dot, whatever your color is, it doesn't really matter. But sometimes just what you've been taught all your life may not necessarily be true, and you fear something, how are you ever going to know and go beyond that unless you sit down at the table with somebody, break bread, talk to them, and get to know them and understand them. And
right,
perhaps
extend yourself.
Yeah. That'll give you another perspective, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to. My dad used to say, don't judge a man, Don Zelay. Sit down and try and walk a mile in his shoes. Put yourself into his or her situation. And so once you do that, then you start to take on someone else's perspective, and that helps you to gain a level of understanding. And
Absolutely.
Then you can, you know, make a more educated, you know, summary of the situation, of the dynamics, and it will, you know, help you to help them or help you to help yourself to understand them. And so, it's empathy. And it's so much easier. It's just so much easier to come to someone, to be open. You know, let's say you're encountering someone who's angry and they're vehement. You don't have to meet that same level of anger. You can't meet fire with fire. You've got to be, you know, become calm and then say to that person, what upsets you so much? I have empathy for you. I have understanding for you. Let me help you. What is it? And then just keep digging down until you strike a human chord of it. By showing your humility and your compassion and your empathy and your understanding, they eventually end up letting down that guard, and then they look at you and they're like, "Oh, my goodness, I'm so sorry. Actually, I was just so frustrated because, you know, I work too hard, or people don't understand me, or, you know, there are too many cars on the road and there's too much, road rage." And then, you know, all of a sudden you break through that veneer, because we, you know, all of us usually have that wall and that facade around us. But if you come, you approach somebody genuinely and sincerely and honestly, you can break down those walls and that barrier that divide you and reach them.
Wow.
You know,
that's,
reach
that's,
their heart.
Yeah, that is really awesome. You know, Donsley, I think that leads into, right now I'm going to take a break really quick because I think this would be a perfect time for us to hear a song that's just so appropriate for this. You had touched on this, and like I said, this is no Christian show, but I have a friend that's out of Nashville who's a singer. Her whole family are very well-known singers, the Rambos, and her grandmother composed a song years ago. And really, it's really kind of what your behavior, if you're walking in tune to what you really believe deep down inside, treating others with respect.
Mm-hmm.
If you claim to be somebody that believes in God, whether you're a Jew, whether you're a Christian, whether you're a Muslim, it doesn't matter. If you believe what you believe, then you're going to treat people with that dignity and respect and love and kindness. And like you were saying, extending out the olive branch. But, you know, I kind of like to think of when I heard this song, I thought it was cool because it reminded me of being in a place that maybe we're not comfortable with, wherever we're at in life. Maybe it's unknown to us. Maybe it's just not an environment that we're comfortable with. And if you take quiet time outside of yourself and just say, you know what, God, I want to understand. I want to converse with you. I want to love people. I want to extend, like what you said, that branch out to people, that olive branch. I want to be that tool. I want to make people smile. I want them to say, you know what, you're not like what I heard to be afraid of or fearful of. You have extended yourself. I understand you. I understand, you know. Then we're really walking in love. And so this is really a very cool song. And I'd like to take this time as we're doing a break where we've been talking to actress and civil rights activist Donsley Abernathy. And now we're just going to take a quick just break. And with me is an artist from Nashville, Tennessee, Destiny Rambo McGuire, and she's going to sing for us, "I Just Came to Talk with You, Lord." But it's really kind of cool because you could imagine being like in maybe a lounge, a bar, a jazz lounge, whatever, kicking back, and you might hear Destiny singing this song.
You, Lord.
Thank you, Destiny. That was Destiny Rambo McGuire, all the way from Nashville, Tennessee. And joining me back again is my friend here. And are you there, Donsley Abernathy?
Oh, my goodness, Joey, I am. That was beautiful.
Wasn't that awesome?
Oh, my goodness. I came to talk to you, Lord. I love that.
Isn't that cool? Yeah, her grandmother, Dottie Rambo, was a very famous gospel singer and songwriter. Destiny is holding her own. She's her family were known for her mom was involved too with the Rambos, which was a gospel group, kind of country, right? And then she kind of moved off from there, and she started singing with Andre Crouch and the Disciples, and she went into contemporary music. And then Destiny's father is a really great singer and songwriter and pastor. So she's really blessed by being the child of, you know, just these of Donnie McGuire and Reba Rambo, the granddaughter of Dottie Rambo. And so she's just blessed, and she's just moving into her own world. You know, she does.
For sure.
She does things for Disney and Mary Poppins and SeaWorld and all this stuff. So she's got a great voice, great person, great soul. And so I'm glad you. And, you know, it was just, wasn't it right, just really appropriate, right? It was just
absolutely.
Really appropriate. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, so we thank her for singing that song. So now we were talking about how you started and civil rights and being your father, Dr. Abernathy, you know, being very involved in the cause of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and being raised in that, and then knowing that you had this call to really go beyond anything having to do with civil rights and get more into acting. Not that you wouldn't be involved in civil rights later on, but really you wanted to pursue something else. So tell me, when did this happen and how it happened, how you got your first break and all that?
Well, like I said, we did these plays. We would put on an Easter play and a Christmas play, and then our acting teacher was Yoki's official acting teacher. He taught me as well. Yoki, by the way, was Martin Luther King's oldest daughter, Yolanda. Anyway, his name was Mr. Walter Roberts, and I loved him. I just loved him so much. And he would never let me participate, but sometimes I could watch. And then his son Eric would make sandwiches. And then they had this little baby, Julia, who had this big mop of curly hair. They lived in this house. Anyway, Julia grew up one day to become the Julia Roberts. But her dad taught us acting.
Wow.
And, so that's where I started. And then when we got to public high school, went to Northside High School of the Performing Arts. Then, and I performed there. And then I left there and went to boarding school in Pennsylvania. And then just started doing the plays at the George School and loving it. And then after that, you know, time came for me to go to college, and I wanted to go to Yale. I went to Yale, and, my visit, that's when I found out that, you know, going to Yale undergraduate did not mean that I would be a part of the drama school. And I was like, oh, no, I can't go to Yale. My parents were so upset. I had good grades and everything, and I was like, I can't go to there. Yale, they won't let me perform. So then I went around trying to find a college that would allow me to perform as a freshman, because that's all I wanted to do was perform. You know, it was a way of living. My dad thought I was going to go to Boston University because Uncle Martin had gone there, and they had a great theater at BU. But once I got to BU, it was so huge, I knew that I couldn't, you know, I'd only be known as a number, you know, basically by my Social Security number. So then I went to Emerson College in Boston, and I learned. And while I was there, I was working and doing all the plays. And then I went out and got my SAG card in my first production, and then immediately upon graduation, I went and applied in Atlanta for a job on a play and got hired for a touring company of a play called For Colored Girls Who've Considered Suicide When the Rainbow's Enough, and I was Lady in Orange. you know, at that point I had, you know, really naturally long hair. So they were like, okay, you can play the black woman who pretends she's Latino. And so that was great. That's what Lady in Orange's whole thing is about. And so we did a tour of, you know, whole southeastern tour all the way down to Key West, Florida, and up to Virginia. And it was called a bus and truck tour. And then from there, you know, I did Antony and Cleopatra, Shakespeare with Jane Alexander, and one of the actors in the play, Ed Moore, his agent, had come down from ICM in New York, and at the end of one of my performances, he came through and asked me would I be one of his clients, and so I was like, yeah, but I'm going back to Boston. And I kept thinking, well, I'll just do theater. I never thought I'd end up on television or anything like that. Then, you know, you do one play after the next, and then as I tried to branch into movies and TV, the parts were not there for me, and I thought, this is crazy. I'll go and work behind the camera. So then, because, you know, they weren't going to cast me, they were like, well, we're going to hire a white woman for this part. You know, you did a great audition, but, you know, you're black. And so I just decided I'd work behind the camera, and I spent 7 years behind the camera, and then I moved to Los Angeles. My dad was like, you're not supposed to be working behind the camera. You're supposed to be pursuing your dream, and it's time to go to California. So he put me in the car and shipped me west. And I kept saying, oh, I don't want to go. I don't want to go out. If I go, I'll leave you. And I thought, well, I'm just supposed to be a, you know, servant to my dad, too, you know, just take care of him. And he was like, no, you're going to go live your life, and your mother is with me, and I'm fine, and goodbye. And I went west. And as soon as I got here, my first audition I got a part in The Long Walk Home. It was a Whoopi Goldberg, Sissy Spacek movie. My first scene ever on a movie was with Sissy Spacek, and that was just thrilling. And then I got another movie, Ghost Dad, right after that. Sidney Poitier was directing, and he hired me as an actress. And then after that, I got a lead in a movie called Murder in Mississippi, and it was great. And then I felt like I was off and running. But, you know, it's like one, two, three, I got three things in a row, and then the friends are like, well, that doesn't happen normally in Hollywood, and this isn't the way it works, and then they start planting seeds of doubt.
Right,
and then,
right.
You know, and it's terrible, and it had an effect on me, and things slowed down. And then eventually things picked back up again, and I got to do a job, a Western called Ned Blessing, which was great. It was written by a guy named Bill Whitliff, who'd written Lonesome Dove, and he wrote The Perfect Storm. He'd written Black Stallion. It was just great working with Bill. And then what happened? That was my first series. I did Amazing Grace, another series that didn't run too long, with Patty Duke up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And, you know, television work was yeah, it was beautiful up there. And television work was great, but the movies were incredible. I'll never forget working on Other People's Money with Gregory Peck, and they ultimately ended up cutting me out of the scene with Gregory Peck and cutting most of his performance out of the movie, because he had dominated the movie, and it wouldn't have been a comedy. You know, it would have been the Gregory Peck serious hour versus the Danny DeVito comedy. But Mr. Peck was great. We used to sit on the set every day, and he taught me how to break down my script. He taught me my craft. And then, yeah, it was great. And because I was on location for a long time, because at that point my first husband worked behind the camera, I would spend one day every week with Veronique Peck and Mr. Peck. I called him Mr. Peck. And then another day during the week with Dixie Jewison and Norma Jewison's wife. And it was great, because, you know, we were the wives on location, and I was an actress. And, you know, Mr. Peck wanted to teach, and I wanted to be his sponge.
So let me ask you, you something, Donzelay. We have people that, you know, are actors and actresses. I act as well. But, you know, what is it that if you had to say something that you learned about the craft of acting from Gregory Peck, something that anybody could take away, what would that be? I mean, you said he helped you, like, break down the script, right?
But he also said something to me that I'll never forget as long as I live. He says, I never say anything that I don't believe. So Mr. Peck at that point was almost, like, he had to be 80 or close to 80, and they had this thing where he enters the bank. So what he would do is he was walking to the bank. He would not stand outside the door and then walk in. He would start a whole block away, and he would be walking. And so by the time he crossed the street and had gotten close, they would say, stand by, roll camera. And by the time that Mr. Peck got just before the door, Norman would wait, and then he would say, action. But Mr. Peck had already been at it. He was at
right.
And he said, I never say a word that I don't believe. And it made such clear sense to me. And, I worked on another movie with Ruth Gordon, who was a great actress, and her husband, Garson Kanin, was a great writer, and they used to write all those movies for Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. And
right.
Ruth Gordon said to me, I'll never forget, I was her personal dresser. This was when I was working behind the
mm-hmm.
camera.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd sit with her always on the set, and she said to me, you're not there, because she wanted to teach me as well. She knew I was an actress. She said, you're not on set to win friends and influence people. You're here to give the best performance. What matters the most is what you do once you get in front of that camera. So what she would do is she put on her headset, which is something that I ended up doing now, and made it a way of life for me, is putting on my headset, studying my lines, or putting myself in that mood. And she listened to La Cage aux Folles. And she would just be dancing and singing to the music and that she's listening to in her head and not speaking to anybody. Very isolated. She always had me near her. And once they got ready for her to come on set, then she'd hand her pocketbook to me and want me to be in close proximity so she could see me because I was her person. And, it was great being with her, but her only relationship on that movie was with me. She'd work with the other actors, and once they said cut, then she'd find her way to me, or I'd immediately go to her. And then she liked to talk about the craft.
Mm-hmm.
The other person that was instrumental in teaching me was Tyne Daly,
mm-hmm.
Who was the star of Cagney and Lacey and
mm-hmm.
all these, Judging Amy, she played Amy Brenneman's
mm-hmm.
mother. Tyne taught me about the audition process. And,
mm-hmm.
Her oldest daughter had been one of my dearest friends, and when she'd gone away to college, Tyne would have me come over once a week. She'd have dinner, and all these actors would come. And then, she would want to know how everything was going for me, everything, And she helped me get my first big agent. Because once I left ICM and was no longer in, doing the East Coast thing, and I was out here in California, Tyne was, she was like the mother. She was like telling me, okay, you're going to wear that, and she gave me a bunch of clothing. I mean, I owe so much to Tyne. And, when you leave an audition and you didn't get the part and you're feeling so bad and you're beating yourself up over the head and you're running through it in your mind, Tyne would teach me how to let it go. And then
she used
to say to me, oh, yeah, she told me how to let it go. And then she said to me, you don't go to the mailbox without your face on. You never know who you're going to encounter. And I'll never forget, one day I was with my husband and we were walking through the streets of Beverly Hills, and it was early in the morning and I hadn't made my face up. And I'm walking down the street, and we pass this outdoor cafeteria, and I see the costume designer that I'd worked with on three shows. And
mm-hmm.
then I speak to her briefly, Hope Hannafin, and then she introduces me to this movie director, I think it was Sam Raimi or Sam Mendes, and he was married to Kate Winslet. And I was like, oh, no. And I thought immediately, as soon as she got ready to make the introduction, all I could hear was Tyne's
mm-hmm.
voice in my head, and I kept thinking, I have on sweats, my hair's
mm-hmm.
all over my face,
mm-hmm.
I have on these sunglasses. If
mm-hmm.
I take him off, my eyebrows may not be brushed. I have on no makeup, no lipstick, no nothing. I mean, it was nice enough to meet him, but it would have been better if I met him, looking better. So she helped me. Actors help each other. That's the thing that I love. Great actors.
Yeah.
We are generous.
Yep.
We are so generous to a fault. I did this movie called Don King Only in America, and I was Mrs. Don King, working with Ving Rhames.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. I loved being with him so much. I just adored it. I'll never forget one day. I don't even know what the scene was. I just remember before we were in this hotel room, and I had on this, like, negligee, and jumping up and down on the bed, like, because I was showing him what Uncle Martin used to have us do.
Mm-hmm.
In the hotel suite, would jump up and down. So I'm jumping up and down on the bed, and Ving is there with me, and we're laughing. And Vondi Curtis Hall, who was another actor, he's like looking like, oh, my goodness, they're crazy. But where I wanted to go emotionally, Ving went with me.
Right.
And wherever he went, I went with him. I'll never forget, there's this one scene, and he was so sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember why his character, Don King, was so sad, but
mm-hmm.
I just remember that they had me open the door, and when I saw Ving so sad, it broke my heart, and I mean, genuinely broke my character's heart, and then my heart, and then all of a sudden, tears just start streaming down my face. I'm not boo-hooing, but the tears just are running, and the camera is in my face, and the camera, what he did was he changed the focus so that it was no longer Ving. Ving went to fuzzy, and I went in clear. And then they put it in the rough cut, the final cut of the movie. And the director was saying that the HBO people were like, you can't put that scene on her. It'll all be about her. It's got to be about him. And so they ultimately ended up, using only a slice of me in that, making the focus back on Ving. But it was... You know, for me, it was great nonetheless because this love that happens between actors, this camaraderie, this friendship, and, you know, and then right after the movie's over, sometimes the relationships last and then other times they don't, and then you move on, you know?
But absolutely.
You pour your heart.
Right. You know, it's kind of funny. You were talking about... you were talking about walking on the street with your husband, you know, in Beverly Hills, and the advice that that actress had given you. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I started to I've done some acting on the side as well. I'm a musician. I sing and I act on the side. But I'm not going to tell you the actors that were involved in this, but I'll just tell you that I had two incidences that I guess we have to really be careful, A, what we wish for, and then we have to really be cognizant of those people that are around us, you know. So I was doing some stand-in work for a television show, and so it was late at night, and one of the stars had fallen asleep. We were filming in San Francisco, and one of the stars had fallen asleep in this car. And so it's actually early morning. It was like 1 or 2 in the morning, actually, now that I recall. And so they were looking for somebody that might look kind of Hispanic. And so I was there with a friend of mine, and we had been doing some extra work. And so they were arguing. I saw these producers arguing. They were looking our way, and they were arguing, and one was pointing at my friend, and then one was pointing at me. And the guy walks up to me. He says, you know, I don't know if you're Hispanic or not, but what we want to do is we want you to try this actor that fell asleep, the star, one of the stars. We want you to try his suit on because he can't do the part, and we're wondering if maybe you could do the part, you know, but they'll only see your back, and they'll, you know, you'll be in makeup and they'll do this and that and blah, blah, blah. So I went and I tried on the suit, and wouldn't you know it, it fit me perfectly, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I come out and I go, yeah, it fit me perfectly. Perfect. Okay, so next thing I'm on a trolley and I'm doing this scene and I'm playing this guy who's asleep in his truck or whatever, you know. So now I'm playing his part, right? Well, the following week they had offered me to be his stand-in. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And Don Zelay, I'm telling you, I really blew it because we had to film this one scene in Oakland. And so somebody said, oh, I heard that they asked you to be, you know, so-and-so's, you know. And I said, yeah, can you imagine? I'm so much younger, and I definitely don't look like. Well, guess what? He was right behind me. And the
wow.
person was like, the person was signaling me like, you know, Joey, you just better shut up, you know? And the guy was right behind me, and I felt so bad. And it's like, you know, I could have used that as a positive thing, you know? But mm-hmm. I wasn't too
Listen,
smart.
Listen, you can't, don't beat up on yourself. You have to let that
I
go.
Do. I know. And then, you know, you were talking about parts. I've beat myself up over, I wanted to do this one part as this, I had read for this part for, it was like a Hispanic family. And this uncle part, and the producer said, he goes, you know, then the director said, you know, you were excellent. You did a great job in reading, and we believe you. But the thing is that you just don't look Mexican enough, you know? Well, I'm not Mexican,
right.
But, you know, you don't look. And I'm like, oh, geez, you know, you're typecast. You know what I'm saying? And I was just talking to a director and film producer the other day, and he has a new film coming out. And he's like, well, but we can't fit you for this. We can't fit, you know, maybe this. And he's like, I don't even think you look Hispanic. You look more white to me. And I'm thinking, white? Where do you? But, you know, people see different – they see different things, right? When they look
yes.
at you, they see different things. And if you're a person of color, well, you know, sometimes you're typecast into things that, that you know, it does – I don't know. Sometimes I think I would like
change.
To –
You have to change. That's why you have to be like a chameleon, and that's why
yeah,
you have
absolutely.
To morph. And what you have to do is go get that – go get some kind of bottle tanning lotion on your face and go look like you're tanned and then you know dress more like a younger Latino man and
yeah.
they won't doubt it, you know, grease your hair back or whatever stereotype, because that's what the actors have to do. I mean, I'll never forget when I auditioned for Ned Blessing,
right,
I put on like three layers of clothing because at that
right.
point I was really skinny.
Right.
And one of the things that I wore was my dad's jean jacket that
uh-huh.
you know, he and Uncle Martin used to wear to jail, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I wore it, and I had it done up to the neck, and then mm-hmm. I pretended I had a gun, and I would look like I was tough. I put dark mm-hmm. circles underneath my eyes, and I didn't comb my hair. I messed it up, and I put dark on my lips. So that I just looked gruff and ruddy. And of all the women at the audition that day, I by far looked the worst. And so finally, when I got the job and I arrived in Austin, Texas, and we were filming, and anyway, we meet the writer, Bill Whitless, and he looks at me. And a few days later when we're filming, he pulled me over to the side. He said, "You tricked me. You tricked me. I thought you looked different." I was like, oh, and I started laughing. And then when I did this TV series Any Day Now for 4 years, they, you know, they never saw me out of makeup and hair. I mean, and I wore a fat suit. And every
mm-hmm.
time the crew saw me, they was in the fat suit, and they saw me in the gray wig or the short wig, and I put
right.
cotton in my mouth like Brando did for The
right.
Godfather. And so that's all they ever saw. And then one day, I'll never forget, I was leaving the set, and I needed to go on the set to see Annie Potts for something. And, you know, security's trying to stop me. I'm like, I'm Don Zelay. I play one of the actors. They finally let me through. And once I got on the set, the grips and the electrics, I started to speak to them. Like, who are you? And they couldn't believe that it was me because they'd
right.
never seen me. I'd never
right.
let them see me out of my character. But, you know, you just have to
you're right.
You have to do that. You have
no,
to morph.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, I have. I mean, you know, even last night I was talking to somebody and they're like, oh, I absolutely see you as a Hispanic, or I could see, because I am part Hispanic, but they're like, I could definitely see you as being Hispanic, or you look ethnic to me. So I think everybody sees something different. But this guy, this producer said, and I beat myself up about it. He said, see, I could type, he says, you have that kind of Clooney thing going on because of your gray hair. And he said, on the sides, and you kind of look Italian. So if we were doing a film that had to do with an Italian family or something like that, this would be perfect. But, you know, so I was like, I can't believe it, you know. I thought I would, you know.
Well, you
but
know what,
I
you need,
need
to just go put streaks and tips on the side, take away the gray. You could, you know, you wash, they wash in and out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm serious. And go present yourself to this guy and then shock him. You have to. Because that's what all the movie stars do. They transition.
Yeah,
they're not playing themselves.
I
mean, unless, of course, you know, it's, you know, Cary Grant, you know, Gary Cooper, those guys play themselves over and over and over again, or Brad Pitt. But, you know, you just have to, you need to go back to this guy and can you do it? Can you meet him again and show him?
Nah, this was years ago, but I still beat myself up over it. It's kind of crazy, you know. I mean, Don Soleil, I've learned a lot of things, and I've said, you know, through my life, how I started the acting, and this is not about me, so I'm just going to let it go. But, I mean, when I was 19 years old, I used to do look-alike stuff for Eric Estrada, for Chips when that was out. And then that's how I got all interested. And before that, I did, you know, music and all my life and plays and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, that's how I moved forward. But you know, I could kick myself. I mean, I was asked to do a part last year, and it would have been great. But I kept going, I don't want to be gone from my home for 3 weeks for filming. No, I don't want to. So I kept saying, no. And, you know, sometimes we have to say yes to really live the dream. We have to be willing to say, you know what, just like what you did, say, you know what, I don't want this. This is where I want to go. And I think, you know, I am doing that now, so I'm grateful. So this is why I like stories like yours, because, and we're going to transition, believe it or not, we've been talking for a little over an hour, and we are going to transition in this final half hour. We're going to start transitioning into more of the civil rights stuff and why it's a passion. And I really, like you know, we've already discussed this on the phone, I was really absolutely shocked. I'm asking you now to take your hat off as an actress, and we're going to go into in this last half hour because it's so appropriate for now celebrating the 50 years of the Civil Rights Act, right? Basically,
right,
this
the
is
Civil Rights Bill. That's right.
Yeah. But I had shared this with you that I had never been to the South ever, and then in 1997, I went over to the South, and I was there for a month. And I was really, really shocked, you know, super shocked of what I encountered. And I encountered even racism towards me because they didn't know if I was white or God only knows, you know. They didn't know if I was mixed. They didn't know. And that was very foreign to me. When I was in Washington, D.C. 10 years ago, staying in Warden, it was like an area called, I think it was Wardman Place or something, and it was over this really, this beautiful bridge with lion heads on each side. It was just great, and the hotel we stayed at was just awesome. And I met this black man that was older, probably about 70 years old, and he was shining shoes, and my shoes were all scuffed up, and I needed to, you know, to get my shoes shined, you know? And so there was nobody else there, and he was just a nice guy. And so I remember saying something to him like, you know, now you have to understand, I didn't pay for our hotel, but the hotel stay in this one place was somewhere between $300 and $500 a night. So I asked him how much it would cost to shine shoes, and he said it's about $3. I said, $3? You know, I'm thinking to myself, are you kidding me? And I said, my gosh, I said, people come in here and they're dropping $300 to $500 a night on a hotel. And you're charging, and he sometimes would do 10 customers a day. Sometimes he would do 20. But I was just thinking, my gosh, this is terrible, you know? And I didn't. What's that?
He's working for pennies.
Yep. And that was my first encounter with what I call economic slavery, you know. And then I saw a lot of the black people, how they would talk to the white people, and it got me kind of mad because I was thinking, you know what, we're not in the times of slavery. Don't keep calling me, you know. I mean, Southern people are nice to begin with, you know. They,
well, yeah,
yes,
we
sir,
say
yes,
sir and ma'am,
yeah.
Yes, sir,
but,
yes,
you know,
ma'am.
But I kept telling them, just call me Joey. Don't keep saying, because it made me feel uncomfortable. And it just, it kind of changed my life, you know.
Mr. Joey,
It really changed my life, and I just said,
it opened your eyes to
it opened my eyes.
World.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, you got a chance to see what it's like and what it was like in the South. And, you know, there's the other extreme where there are the young people that are rebellious to that old system, and I can truly appreciate and understand that. But, you know, just so you understand, we've only been free 50 years. Before that, we had 100 years of legalized segregation, the Jim Crow laws. And then before that, we had 244 years of slavery. That's 344 years, and then this year it's 50 years of supposed freedom. But we really didn't get freedom until, let's say, really like 1965, 66. You know, because even things weren't even really integrated. I mean, Latino people started to integrate with white people in 1967, so pretty much 68, 69 to 70. Those have been the only years of freedom in America. So we were enslaved longer than we were free, and those old theories and those old ways die hard. They die so hard that the other day, the Supreme Court decided that there can be no limits on political spending, that any amount of money any one individual could donate. So the Koch brothers could, donate millions of dollars to a political campaign in Alabama. And it was Alabama, that same old southern state that I was born in, that the Alabama went to the Supreme Court asking that there be unlimited amounts of money donated by an individual. And the Supreme Court, Justice Roberts, the Supreme Court let it pass. And, of course, Clarence Thomas, a black man raised in the South in Savannah, went along with it because he's still caught up in that slave mentality, you know, because he follows Justice Roberts and Scalia with the ideology that hurts and hampers his people. And then again, it was that same Alabama that challenged the Supreme Court, which made them struck down Section 4 and Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which then said, and then they tried to say in the South that, you know, we don't have discrimination while we have black people in the public office, you know, and it's all orchestrated so that they can eliminate people of color's voting rights, because when they take away your voting rights and make it impossible for you to vote, then they can control that political system. And once they control that political system, then they surreptitiously take away the rights of the people. We no longer have a voice. And when they struck down Section 4 and Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, Texas and North Carolina immediately decided that they were going to make it difficult for people to vote. Mm-hmm. And now they're trying to make it difficult so that college students, let's say you go to college for 4 years in North Carolina. Well, they say that because you're a student living for 4 years in North Carolina and you're a college student and you're not a legal resident, then therefore, of course, you are a legal resident because you're living there. They're trying to say that you can't vote there. Well, that's crazy that you have to vote at your home where you grew up, where you don't live. Because 10 months out of the year, or even let's say if you're going to summer school, you're hanging out there in the summer, you're there 12 months out of the year, and they're trying to say that you're not a resident there. But these are the things in the way that they're trying to do it. They're trying to redistrict. And that's why we needed the Justice Department inside monitoring voting practices in these southern states. And they're interested in doing the same thing that they did during the period of Reconstruction, and I'm passionate about this, where they took away our right to vote, where they took those black men and no longer allowed them to have public office. And they're trying to do it because they don't want blacks to rise up, they don't want Latinos, they don't want women. The other day was the last day, March 31st was the last day of Women's Month. March is Women's Month. And the Republican Party basically was saying that the Republican Party doesn't need to change. Women need to change. Women need to just go home from their jobs and just be housewives, take care of their children, and let their husband run the business. And then there would no longer be inequality of women in the workplace. So they're trying to take women backwards. They're trying to take America backwards. And what we've got to do is rise up and stop this. Because, listen, like I said, in my lifetime, I remember segregated life water fountains. I've seen America change in my lifetime. I'm not going backwards, and these young people don't need to go backwards. We need to have an informed constituency, an informed young people, and stand up and rise up and speak out and claim our future. I'm so adamant and deliberate about this. I want us to do something. Anyway.
Well, I guess that was my – that was my next question. Well, my question was, do you think really in these 50 years we've actually progressed forward or we're progressing backwards?
Well, we were progressing forward, and then all of a sudden, because our president became the lightning rod for these advocates – I'm sorry, can you hear my husband? I don't know. He's in the background talking. But
he became
– You can hear him? Okay.
A little bit. That's okay.
Okay. He became the lightning rod for these advocates of hate, regretfully. And so the Tea Party rose up and came to be. And, you know, it's nothing but the addressed-up version of the White Citizens Council. You know, they're going around trying to say Martin Luther King was a Republican. Of course he was not. Then trying to say that, you know, they represent the American people when, in fact, they're just, you know, I mean, they really are like that White Citizens Council and the KKK, and they want to take up arms, and they want to arm America, and they want to have another civil war and have us fighting and killing each other, and then instead of trying to find a way to work together, I don't know what Michelle Bachmann and all the rest of them are after, but I know that they want to move us backwards, and we're not going backwards. We're not. We're not. And
well,
granted,
I don't think anybody
put on their side.
Well, I don't think anybody should go backwards, and I think
Of course we shouldn't, but people are not informed, and people are we're much more selfish and self-absorbed and complacent and not being astute, and they're trying to create fear. They're trying to say that Obamacare is not going to work and health care isn't going to work, and that you know, Rand Paul's trying to say that Social Security should be eliminated, and that when Social Security was created, you know, it was only going to be for like 58,000 people, but and trying to insinuate that Franklin Delano Roosevelt wasn't looking at the long picture of where it would go. But of course he was. And then they want to try and strike down all these social programs, and then they want to entitle the super, 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 super rich. But, you know, I'll never forget this biblical story of this rich man. They said it is easier to thread the eye of a needle with a camel than it is for a rich man to make it into the kingdom of heaven.
Right.
Because, you know, so, you know, and being that I grew up in the church, you know, I believe those things. And when I look at so many people and that have become so rich, and there's nothing wrong with being rich, the question is, what are you giving back? How did you make
Absolutely.
That money? And who did
Absolutely.
You take from to get to where you are? And what ruthless thing did you do, you know? I look at the Koch brothers and I hear these things that they're trying to do, and I'm thinking, what have you done for anybody? And you know, I spoke recently in Oakland, Daughters of the Civil Rights Movement, with Lucy Baines Johnson, who is just a gem, who is fighting for her father, Lyndon Baines Johnson's work to keep these things alive that he did, because, of course, he signed the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Act. And with Carrie Kennedy, the daughter of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., one of the daughters of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and then Peggy Wallace Kennedy, one of the daughters of George Wallace, who talks about her father and about the transition that he made in his life. And, you know, he was a staunch segregationist who said segregation now, segregation today, segregation forever, who demanded to see my father before he died to apologize for how hateful he had been during the days of the Civil Rights Movement. And so people change, and that very prejudiced, hateful mind will become a loving mind. But when I look at people like Rand Paul, who's riding on the backs of his father, the wealth of his father, who's trying to take away from poor people who have so nothing. And, you know, I think you know, where is your compassion? Where is your humility? My God, where are you going to end up at the end of your life? My God, what will those final hours be like for you, Rand Paul, when you ask for forgiveness before God takes you from the earth? How much suffering are you going to endure? How much suffering are you sending into the lives of people?
Wow.
You know, I am my brother's keeper.
Right.
I cannot see somebody. I'll never forget this lady falling down on the street with her grocery, and I'm walking, and so I ran over to her, and I helped her, and she's a Russian lady. She was asking me, can I give you money? No, why are you helping me? I said, because you've fallen.
Right.
But she was so afraid that, you know, here's this black woman. Lady, she doesn't have anything I want.
Right.
I can't walk by and see her in the gutter. I'm that good Samaritan. I see somebody, I've got to reach down and lift them up, and I have to
That's
help
right.
them because it helps me to sleep better at nighttime. And I mean, I can't take food out of the mouth. They're trying to cut away. My father created this program out of the Poor People's Campaign where low-income children get to get a free meal at school, and they get a free breakfast and a free lunch. And now in San Bernardino, they're trying to give them a free dinner. I'll never forget, I was there speaking at this school, and lunch had ended, and they were trying to get the children to go back, and there was this one black kid and this one Latino kid, and they were wolfing down the food, and the teacher said, okay, it's time to go back, go to class. And he's like, no, please, I've got to eat. If I don't eat, I won't eat anymore today.
Oh, my God.
And I said, I'll stay with him, and I'll walk him to class. And the one of the kids, this white kid, white and Latino kid, he was the grandson of the movie star Ernest Borgnine, and he's wolfing down this. And granted, Ernest Borgnine had a whole lot of money, but his grandson didn't. His grandson's mother didn't. So they're living out there in San Bernardino, and granted, he may not have been getting that free meal program, but that black kid was. And now you're going to take that meal away from those children? Those children need that breakfast. And when I go into San Bernardino and I'm there in the schools and I see those children wolfing down that breakfast in the morning, they need that nutrition so they can then calm down and go into that classroom. How can they learn when they're hungry?
Right.
How can they? They need it. And it's not that their parents don't want to feed them. Their parents don't have the money to feed them. And then they're trying to cut this food stamp program, which is another thing that my dad created and lobbied for, the food stamp program out of the Poor People's Campaign in 1968 and 69. And then they created the National Food Stamp Program. And so now they've cut that, and they're trying to take that away. And it's like, are you kidding me?
You know, so, yeah. And you know what, John's late.
Wait,
I just want to say this.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee, check with your congresswoman. She's in your area, in the Bay Area. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, she's an advocate for all these things. You guys need to be aware. Have her come and be on the show and talk about what's happening.
Maybe we can have you come back at the same time, you know?
Okay.
I mean, you never know, right? We'd love to have you come back. And because we've got about 5 minutes left. Can you believe it? I mean, it's really gone really quick. And so we got about 5 minutes left. But, you know, I think what you're saying is so, so important for people to hear. There's so many things. There's so much hunger out there. There's so many people that need our help. It doesn't take too much to just reach out to people. It really doesn't.
It doesn't. I mean, come on. We grow produce for the rest of the world, and you're telling me you've got hungry people in the United States of America, and now you all want to take food out of the mouths of babes?
Right.
How dare you do that to children? They're our future.
Right.
You know,
well, you know what? I think that there's plenty of, you know, you come to the Bay Area, there's plenty of wealth here, there's plenty of high tech, there's plenty of, you know, and some of those people, maybe they are already donating a lot, but they could up the ante. And when you have people living high and mighty, you said it earlier, there's nothing wrong with being rich, but it's what are you doing with your wealth? If you're just keeping your wealth, hoarding it to yourself, you're not willing to reach out to other people, you're not willing to help other people, then, you know, it's gonna bite you in the rear end sometime in your life.
Oh,
and it will. You know,
how many shoes can you purchase, and how many can you wear? You can only wear them one at a time. There are only 365 days in the year. How many dresses? How many suits? I mean, what are you going to do with all these material things? And when you leave this earth, you leave it all behind. But what go with you is your spirit. And what is in your spirit and what's in your heart and what's in your soul, what will you have done? What will they say about you that you did in your lifetime for somebody else? We don't know Martin Luther King Jr. today because of the things that he had and the things that he grasps. We know him because of the things that he gave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why that statue in Washington that they created is wrong. His arms were never crossed. They were always open, his hands wide open, because he was giving. The bed that my mother sleeps in today, that bedroom suit, Uncle Martin bought it for my mother and my dad. He gave. He was a giver. My dad was a giver. You know, they weren't trying to hoard things. My dad used to say, I don't need a fancy car. A car is just transportation to get me from point A to point B.
That's right. Well, and you know what? You said key stuff. This is why it really kills me when I see anything in excess, and that includes evangelists and everything else, because I'm thinking to myself, what kind of representation are you? What are you really saying to the world, you know? And if you really want to be a good representative of God, if that's your calling in life, or a good steward, somebody that's a good Samaritan, then go the extra mile. Be willing to take what you've been
blessed
with.
Be like Bill Gates and give back. Be like Warren Buffett and give back.
Well, see, there's a law there, right? So, you know, the Bible talks about it. People talk about it. The book, The Secret, talks about it. You know, when what you sow in life, you reap.
That's right.
You sow bad seed into the ground, you're going to reap a harvest of bad. You know, it's just going to be bad. What's
going
to come?
And if you sow love, the seeds of love.
And if you sow love, then that's what you're going to you sow love.
You reap a harvest of love.
And you're going to reap a harvest. And, you know, we can take that with us even in our personal lives, Don Zalay, even with family and friends, you know. You know, there's a lot of people that like to stir things, you know. But at the end of their life, if you've made other people's lives terrible and all you do is criticize and judge other people and you're never able to, like you said, extend that branch out to somebody in love, and you're always finding the wrong, you're always just saying, oh, they don't need this, they don't need that, and blah, 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 and all you're doing is spreading hate, then that's what, in your last days, that's what you're going to get. You're not going to get the love. And that's really what we need to do, is really be willing to reach out to people. And I think that's what you've told us today, and I'm really happy that you joined us, because really, if your father was alive today, go ahead.
No, I'm just thinking, if he was here today,
he'd be so proud of you. He would be
I'm so proud of him.
Yeah.
I just want to honor him and want to honor Daddy and Uncle Martin. My mother's still here. She did so much. Juanita Odessa Jones Abernathy, that's her name. But, you know, they were just so great. I'm just so blessed to be born to the family that I was born to in that time in history, and to be able to witness, to have a bird's eye view of everything. And all the major decisions were made pretty much in my parents' family room, because Uncle Martin wanted everything to happen at our house. But, you know, I'm just so blessed, and to whom much is given, much is expected. I must give something back. I must be about something. You know, we are our father's children. And so, you know, I go around and I talk about it, and I'm so honored that I was blessed to join the Daughters of the Civil Rights Movement. But I got a friend named Juliana Roosevelt, whose grandfather was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who wants to give back as well. And it's so great. We get together and we talk about what's happening in the world, and, you know, and what we can do to make this place a better place. We want to give. We don't want to take.
And I thank you so much for joining us. Our time is about ended. So I just want to thank you once again, Don Zalay Abernathy,
you.
for joining us and sharing your heart. And I know, folks, if you're interested in finding out more about Donzella, we are going to put her IMDb page up, which is an actor's page, and there will be information on how you can reach her or her manager.
So they can know it.
Well,
Donzelleigh, Donzella Abernathy. And go to IMDb, Internet Movie Database, to find out about me. And, oh, Joey, thank you. And thank you to all of the listeners, to the people that just tune in and just listen for a moment. You're a gem, and thank you. I'm so honored, so honored.
Well, we were honored to have you, and really you've done a wonderful job and continue to be that light to the world, because really that's what we really need to be, just shining stars out there for all to see. And that's really what we really should be in. Boy, I made it rhyme, didn't I? Anyway, I remember there was a song like that, right? Years ago.
Shining Star. No matter
but
who
anyway,
you are.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe we're dating ourselves. Anyway, but it's been a pleasure. I hope I get the chance in this life to meet you in person. But again, thank you so much. And I want to just remind people, definitely go on to the show page. It will spell out Donzella Abernathy's name for you, so you don't have a problem there. Actually, we might just put up the IMDb page for you there, so you won't have to do all that work and then type away. But anyway, again, we just want to thank Donzella again for joining us. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Blessings to you. And then, folks, be sure to keep abreast to the shows that we have coming on and moving forward. And definitely take this show and share it. Share it with your friends, with your family, with those people that really do need to hear this message, because it really is a powerful message. And so if you could do that, that would be awesome. Again, we want to be able to take this message. And for you actors and actresses, you learned a lot. For those that follow Donzella and her career, you've learned a lot. For those that really understand what the whole civil rights movement and that bill was about, and where we were and where we are now, this program has been awesome for that. And Donzella has shared her heart. So again, folks, I want to thank you for joining us on Live from the Bay with Joey. And until the next time, this is Joey saying take care.
Thank you for joining us today on Live from the Bay with Joey.